Thanks for joining us on the VitTech Cafe today. I hope you enjoyed the last episode where Jeff interviewed me. And now in this episode, I'm going to interview Jeff. So as Jeff mentioned in the last episode, this is going to be a little different than what we're normally going to give you on the VitTech Cafe interviews. We're not just going to be talking to each other the whole time. In hindsight, that would probably be easier for us, but that's not why we're doing this. The reason we're doing this, well, I guess there's a few reasons. First, we want to let our audience know who we are, where we're coming from, and why we wanted to do this podcast in the first place. Secondly, well, full disclosure, Jeff and I have never done this before. These two interviews have given us the opportunity to practice with interviewing a guest. You'll notice that in our interviews, we're going to focus on the path Jeff and I have taken to get where we are. And we're going to be doing the same thing with all of our guests, but with the future guests, there'll be more than just the path they took that we want to talk about. Lastly, we need practice recording, editing, mixing sound levels, learning how to do all the things you need to do to make a podcast. We're both shocked at just how elaborate and involved the entire process is, and we're trying to learn as much as we can, as fast as we can, so we can put out the best podcasts we can for you, our devoted listeners. I hope you all be devoted listeners. So, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Jeff Backus to the VitTech Cafe. So tell me about your first job in veterinary medicine. What was your role?
So my first job, actually, when I was in high school, I took a class through the high school, what we called the California Regional Occupational Program. And it was basically like 6 weeks in classroom, and it counted for class credit. But then the rest of the semester was a work externship. And that was at a general practice in the city that I lived in. It was called Portola Plaza Veterinary Hospital. I started there as an extern in October, actually almost a year, or almost, that was 1995, almost to the day I started October 23rd. I was there through basically like January, which was the rest of the semester, and then they hired me on in May as a full-time employee. So we were a general practice. The doctor that I worked for was very medicine focused. So I feel like at the time I didn't realize it, but now looking back on it, for the mid 90s, we did a lot more than probably what a normal GP did. Like we did a lot of endoscopy. We did a lot of surgery at the time. Of course, you probably well remember too, there wasn't a ton of like referral options available. So, you know, if there was a splenectomy or a foreign body or things of that sort that needed to be cut, we just did it, you know, at night. There were plenty of nights I slept at the clinic, you know, to watch the patients overnight afterwards, because again, there were no overnight hospitals around to transfer to. So very different time, but definitely gave me a lot of really good training going forward.
That's really interesting. I don't know if when I was in high school, I don't think that type of externship program was available to us. Did you go to a vocational technical school, or was it just a general public high school?
No, it was a general city public high school, and they had, so the class itself was like animal healthcare or something, but they had it for auto body shop, they had it for medical assisting, they had probably 15 or 20 different vocations that you could go to, and it was that same kind of setup, and it counted for class credit. It was actually basically a double class, so it was actually a really cool program, and I'm glad I was able to take advantage of it, because without doing that then, I have no idea where I would have ended up field or not.
Do you think was that something that was offered and you were interested in it to begin with, or is that something where you just said, oh, I think I'm going to take this instead of taking shop this year?
Yeah, no, I basically, my junior and senior year of high school, I had two career paths I was very interested in. One was veterinary medicine, and I was actually becoming a veterinarian because, again, back then I had no idea what a veterinary technician was or did. And then the other was aviation. I also, at the time, I was working on obtaining my pilot's license, so I was like either path, and it was
very
way
different paths.
Very, very different paths, and it was way too difficult and expensive to at the time to try to go be a commercial pilot, so I didn't quote unquote settle on veterinary medicine. It was just a much more attainable path at the time, and there was an avenue to do it through school, so that's why I ultimately chose that. And then once I got into a clinic setting, it was on from there, and I was in. So
well, that's great. We as the veterinary field are lucky to have you. So you started your career as an assistant, essentially, correct?
Yes.
And then you transitioned into being a vet tech. So as far as career path, was that the natural progression to you, or did you think that you were going to try out as being assistant and see where it went from there?
No, working at that general practice there, and I guess really at the time, I certainly had no idea the difference. And so I started as an assistant in 95. I didn't even start RVT school until 2009 or 2007, excuse me. So I got my RVT in 2009. So I was an assistant for 14 years before
Oh, wow.
I before I became a veterinary technician. So until probably 2005, 2006, maybe, I didn't even really understand what the difference was or recognize that there was a difference. Once I went to my first, in 2004, I started at an emergency clinic and they sent me to IVEX. And then I kind of got to see, you know, the difference between assistant and technician and specialty and so on and so forth. And that's really where I kind of started going down that path to get my RVT. And then ultimately that led to specialization and so on.
Gotcha. So as an assistant, were you doing things that technicians were doing, or were you doing in practice that I've worked in, the assistants are essentially there to help hold for procedures. They're hold for, you know, physical exams, for blood draws, things like that. But were you actually doing, like, you know, blood draws, placing catheters, things like that?
Yeah, we were. And there, so I worked for that general practitioner for a solid, and actually, even though now I'm across the country, but as recently as a couple years ago, I've still done relief for him. He and I are very close friends.
Oh, that's great.
But we never really had, I can think of one or two actual credentialed technicians that we had throughout the years while I was there and still as an assistant, like in a full-time role.
Right.
And so us as assistants, though at the time, you know, we all referred to ourselves as techs, but we were all legitimately assistants, but we were doing the blood draws, the catheters, the dentistries, the x-rays, the surgical assisting, like all of that. He absolutely treated us and realistically paid us and all that as and utilized us as technicians. And in California, the Practice Act is pretty rigid in terms of what technicians can do versus assistants and degree of supervision and such. I don't know how it was then, you know, 15, 20 years ago, but he definitely trained us and utilized us as technicians, even though we didn't have the education. And now looking back on it, I completely understand the difference and am actually very protective of that. But at the time, I didn't know any different.
Yeah, I went through a similar situation when I was coming up working in a general practice where we were technically assistants, but they treated us as though we were technicians.
Right, right.
So your passion is now emergency medicine.
Yeah.
And what drew you to the emergency medicine? Was it just going to IVEX in 2004? Because I know every time I've gone to IVEX, I can see how someone would get the emergency bug and say, this is where I want to be. So what drew you to emergency medicine?
The thing was, honestly, the desire for some extra cash. There was an emergency clinic right down the street from where I lived. Excuse me, and they were the overnight weekend holiday ER type, not a 24-hour referral place. And so one summer while I was out of school, I picked up two shifts a night. I think I had like a weeknight swing and a weekend day shift. And I just really took to it. It was fast paced and, you know, just seeing so many different cases, and we were doing a lot more as, again, assistants. And so, you know, it really helped like hone my skills and I was learning a lot more. And so I worked there for a summer, and then the following year I ended up making the transition to full time at that hospital and then switched to part time at the general practice I was at. Did that for a couple of years, and then at that hospital, they actually paid, like through a reimbursement program, they paid for my tech school and actually a couple of other assistants to do the same thing. That's when they started sending us to CE. I had never been to a CE event, let alone a full-blown conference like IVEX previously before that. So, you know, kind of once I started down that path, it just snowballed from there year after year. It just got a little bit more and a little bit more.
Yeah, emergency medicine does tend to draw you in and get you fully immersed in it if you really want to be.
I know,
so
right?
After you made that transition to emergency medicine, then you applied and you achieved your VTS in emergency and critical care in 2013.
Yeah.
And were you still working at the, what they call the overnight emergency medicine?
Yeah. Yeah. I was the first VTS that hospital had. And at the time we had only had emergency doctors until that time. And we had an opening, and we had actually hired on a criticalist that was working as an emergency doctor. So it worked out really well that the year that I was going through from the application up to the exam, she was there, and, you know, it was a really nice like support system and study system in that respect, even though, you know, obviously working with a criticalist isn't required. It was very convenient that maybe 18 months or 24 months that she was there happened to coincide with while I was doing that process. And that was really neat. So it was a big deal, you know, obviously not for me, just not for me personally, but the hospital, because I was the first one to do it as an employee there. They also made it a very big deal and were very supportive of that, which was really cool.
That's great. So after you achieved your VTS, how did your role change at the job you were working at? Or did it change?
I guess it really didn't in a lot of ways, in that because we were mostly emergency and we were in a fairly heavily populated area. So even though we were the overnight weekend holiday ER, there were, within a 20-minute drive in any direction, there were no fewer than 3 or 4 24-hour major referral centers. So we didn't do a lot of critical care. You know, if we had a septic ab, we would most commonly refer it to, you know, a hospital with a surgeon, and then they would manage the case after that. So, you know, I don't think my role necessarily changed in terms of patient care. Certainly my understanding of the patient diseases and all that did. Where I think my role really changed is then that got me more into teaching the rest of the staff that's there. And a couple of the advanced procedures that I learned, you know, then passing that on to the other people, and they became more of a staple, if you will, of things that the practice normally did. And so I think that's really where my role change was training other staff members to, even though I don't think anybody has really gone through the process, they do have one other VTS there now. He did it while he worked for another clinic, but I think they still benefited, if you will, in some way from me having gone through that and teaching them procedures and things that I learned and so on and so forth.
Right. You set the standard for what they needed to do. And a lot of times that's really helpful in having a VTS on staff.
Yeah, for sure.
So after you got your VTS, so you've been on the lecture circuit for quite a few years. How did you get into speaking? Was it just that training aspect of the job that you were working at, or was there something different?
I had also, after I graduated the RVT program in 2009 and actually got my license, I started teaching there at the school I graduated from part-time. I was teaching one class a week. By the time I got my VTS, I had already been doing that maybe 3 or 4 years. So even though like class size was only, you know, 10, maybe 20 students at the most, I had become very comfortable with public speaking. And I was also on, at about that time, I was elected to the board of directors for the California RVT Association. And we had an annual day-long symposium that was put on at UC Irvine. And there was a veterinarian track and a technician track. And one of the other board members at the time asked if I would do a talk. And actually, so my first lecture was on shock. And that was the first conference, quote unquote, if you will, that I spoke at, although there was only one track. So every attendee that was a technician went to the same lecture. So my very first lecture that I gave in a conference or symposium setting had 252 attendees.
Oh my goodness.
And it was a very long room with, so, you know, a typical lecture hall, right, is fairly narrow, but fairly deep. And there's like one, you know, screen. This was the opposite. It was a very long room. And so it had actually 4 screens across the row. And so I just felt like I was like walking back and forth, just pacing, you know, trying to reach everybody. And it was a little bit awkward. And it was my first time doing that. But then once I got through that hour, I was like, I actually really, really enjoyed this. And I did some other small conferences locally, regionally, and then I was trying to work my way up to IVEX, being a speaker there. And then all of a sudden, 1 year, I was like, you know what? Forget it. I'm gonna submit an application for it, and they accepted, and I did IVEX. I think it was 2016 or 17. I forget now. And it's just kind of taken off, and it's something I really enjoy doing. I wish I could do a lot more of it, but you know, it takes a lot to write all the lectures, as you know, and like all the travel and everything that's involved. So I'm trying to temper it a little bit, but it is something that I really enjoy.
That's great. What do you love about it the most?
Honestly, even though I'm a fairly introverted guy, I actually really enjoy like the interaction with people. Not necessarily like the talking. I mean, that's great. But, you know, when people come up after the lecture hour and say, you know, I learned so much, you know, or they have a couple of questions about things, and you can just have really like good, you know, thought-provoking discussion back and forth. I really enjoy that aspect of it. And the other thing, too, is, you know, when you go to a conference, especially if it's one you're traveling to, that once you've been doing this for a while, you make a few friends that are doing the same thing, and then it's seeing all of those people as well that maybe you're sprinkled throughout the country or throughout the world that you don't get to see regularly otherwise, and so you get that you get that aspect of it too, and I think that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's great. The networking aspect of going to all the conferences has to be rewarding in and of itself, because you get to see all those people that we don't really see all the time, which is great. Okay, so just switching gears here a little bit. Your wife is a veterinarian, and I know she went to Tufts while you were working there. How much of the two of you worked together, and were there pros and cons to that, or how did that work out?
Yeah, so we actually worked together at that emergency clinic back in California before she went to vet school. She worked there for about a year before she applied. She applied and got a couple interviews, but didn't get in the first time around, reapplied, and then that's when she got into Tufts the second year. And we actually didn't start dating until after her first year of vet school. We were just friends before she left for school. So we didn't start our relationship till we were 3,000 miles apart. So that was a brilliant idea, but but I'd say it worked out okay. The summer before her third year, which is the year they start clinical rotations, is when I moved out to the East Coast and started my job there. And other than, you know, seeing her in the hospital when she was on clinical rotations, it wasn't until she was on the ER rotation, which is a 3-week rotation, that I actually like really interacted with her. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the students didn't have a required core ICU rotation. They do now, but she didn't have to do an ICU rotation, which I'm mostly in the ICU as opposed to the ER, although we're really only connected by a swinging door. But so I did get to work with her a little bit while she was on that rotation, and she did some elective time in there as well. So I did get to work with her a little bit, and it was very different, obviously, you know, because she was there now to learn how to be a doctor, not how to learn to be an assistant or a technician as it had been in years past. But I think it worked, you know, really well. And I don't feel like we had any difficulty working together. I know some people do, some people don't. But I would hope my coworkers would say the same, that it wasn't that difficult. And in my time there, I worked with another husband and wife. He was a emergency and critical care resident, and she was a technician in our department. And they worked together pretty seamlessly as well. So I feel like at least the couples that I've had that interaction with, I think it's been fine. But now she's off doing her internship stuff, and here we are.
Well, that's great. Do you feel like having you by her side as someone to bounce ideas off of, do you feel like that helped her progress through her courses through vet school, or do you not feel like that was as big of an issue?
I think so, because I mean, even to this day, you know, both of us working in the same field, we like to discuss cases, either cases that she saw or cases that I've had. In fact, we actually just spent this morning doing that over breakfast. But so I think, you know, when she was in the student capacity, as a student, you know, we have interns there, we have residents there, we have faculty there. There were definitely some cases that, you know, at the end of the day, she'd circle back to me. But I think the support system that they have there in terms of learning how to be a doctor, shall we say, I think she was pretty well taken care of there. But if there were certain things or things that she knew, you know, I knew a lot about, you know, she would certainly ask my opinion. But I think otherwise, I think she just mostly use the other resources that were available to her.
Got it. So you've also mentioned that you're at a crossroads in your career. I believe we talked about that in the trailer episode. So where's your career going right now, and where do you want it to go?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one I probably don't really have a full answer for. So I think as I just took another year around the sun a week ago, you know, been doing this now for 25 years, it's getting more and more difficult to get up off the floor, you know, after wrestling a big dog. And it's obviously such a physical job. Thinking that here I am at 41 years old, I can't see myself working in a clinic environment and working in that capacity for another 25 years to retirement. I don't see it. Where I am now in academia, we have several technicians in the hospital that are approaching retirement and will actually like retire as, you know, veterinary technicians that were on the floor, and they'll retire with good benefits because they're in academia. Right. But I think that's just not that realistic for a lot of people. You know, now that I'm newly married and probably going to be starting a family before too long, I kind of am starting to think about what options are available to me potentially in a telecommuting type of role. So things that I'm exploring would be poison control center, you know, other field type jobs, like maybe you know, an IDEX field support representative or something, you know, something that I can be home a little bit more and it's not as physically demanding, but yet still involved in the field. I'm very interested in toxicology, so you know, that's something that I kind of keep coming back to that really intrigues me. But definitely something in the field, but the struggle is real to continue to work in the clinic environment and just such a busy place. It's taking its toll year over year, and depending on where Molly's career takes her and what kind of job she ends up in, you know, may allow for that, it may not, and we'll just kind of have to see. But we're in New England at least for another year, and I'm going to try to ride out the clinic setting for at least that long, and then maybe think about that after we relocate. But those are some of the things that I'm thinking about now, and just seeing whether or not it's actually viable to make that happen.
It's very true. I mean, I've just gone through that myself, where, you know, and I have 5 years on you being in the clinic for that long, and like you said, getting up off the floor after being around, rolling around on the floor with a big dog, gets harder and harder as the years go on. So that's part of why we're doing this podcast, right? We want to give technicians other avenues and right, figure out other ways that people can be productive and have productive careers in the field. So it's good that you're kind of going through that at the same time that I'm going through that, so we right, can give that to our listeners. So thinking about technicians that you've worked with, who inspires you as a technician?
I think a few, you know, especially in the ECC world. I mean, Harold Davis is at the top of that list. I got to moderate for him several years ago before I was really doing any public speaking, and I was such a terrible moderator for him. If we ever have him on the show, I'm going to tell this joke because I laugh with him about it now all the time. But I let him go minutes long because I was so enthralled with what he was saying, and I just totally dropped the ball on actually like telling him time was up. And to this day, I mean, this is like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years later, it's still in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
So he's up there, you know, Liz Houston and Brandy Halua who were so instrumental to, like, you know, kind of launching us and right, a group of us. And now, you know, I think the cool thing is that there's, you know, there's a new wave almost, if you will. And then there's a lot of people who I've met outside of the ECC world just through conferences. I think about, you know, Liza Rudolph and Joe DiFulio, Kristen Cooley, you know, April Bays that was in our group is a big one right, as well. There's so many people that are like starting to work on their own side projects.
Yeah.
And it's just really cool to see people, you know, again, thinking outside the box and thinking of ways outside of that clinic setting and just seeing them kind of, you know, take off. I think that's really cool to see.
Right. There's you and I work in the ECC field, but there are tons of fantastic, amazing technicians that work not in ECC. They work
right,
in IM. They work
right,
in, you know, oncology, things like that.
Yeah.
Just trying to get a handle on who inspired you the most.
Yeah.
So now thinking of the field, and I know you said that you're in that crossroads and maybe transitioning out, other than the just the physical demand of the job, what do you think the biggest challenge that we as technicians face in the field are right now?
That's a tough question. I think there are a lot of things that kind of funnel into some common themes. There's a lot of discussion obviously going on right now about burnout and compassion fatigue and a lot of those kinds of things, underutilization, low pace scale, and lack of opportunity for advancement. And I think all of those things funnel into longevity in the field. And I think that is kind of the common denominator or the end game, because as I mentioned earlier, there just aren't a lot of technicians who say start in this field at whatever it is, 18, 21, 25, whatever, and actually work in a clinic setting through to retirement age. So there isn't a setup like there is, I think, in human nursing to actually evolve all the way up to retirement age. And I mean, I work in academia where, you know, I think the benefits are pretty good. You know, they offer 403A or 401A and 403B and things like that. And there's a lot of clinics out there that don't offer any sort of retirement or any sort of that program. And so, you know, I think back on my career when I was in my early 20s, all I cared about was the dollars. And now here I am in my early 40s. And yeah, the dollars are great, you know, probably maxed out in some ways, but the benefits start to make more sense, you know, like the right, the health insurance, the life insurance, the retirement, those things. And I think there's so many clinics that just aren't set up for that, and so that feeds into people leaving the profession. And it's just this kind of constant cycle of people coming in doing some really cool things for a few years, and then on the backside of that, realizing that there isn't any long-term game there, and so then they go find something else, and it's just this kind of constant cycle. And I'm actually maybe a little bit hopeful, or maybe even a little bit naive, in hoping that maybe that is one area that a lot of these larger corporations that are coming in to buying hospitals, that maybe they can actually start to change that pattern. At least I'm hopeful of that. By being such a large, you know, national corporation, maybe they can offer some of these benefits that might actually lead to more longevity and more of those things. And obviously it's going to be years and years and years to see whether or not that pans out. But I think that's kind of where everything funnels into, is that it's just this constant cycle of people coming in and people going out, because there's just no, you know, they come in, and like what we're going to talk a lot about throughout this series is they come in, they work in a clinic setting, and they don't see a lot of ways out of that. And they kind of accomplish what they feel they can accomplish, and then 5 or 7 years, and it's like, okay, I got to go find something else to do, because I'm not making the money. I don't have childcare. I don't have this. I don't have that. I need to go find something that works better. And I think that's where a lot of people end up. And it's really unfortunate, but I think that's ultimately where a lot of that stuff kind of funnels to.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point. A lot of what happens in the field today is that clinics keep getting bought up by these big corporations, and everyone gets scared, like, oh, we're going to lose our jobs, we're going to lose our benefits. But hopefully, as that transition kind of evens out, the benefits side of things will hopefully make those big corporations be a benefit to us as technicians, as opposed to being something scary.
Right.
So I really hope that is something that does progress throughout the natural course of things, that benefits become better, these big corporations start to look at our field and say, hey, we need to find a way to keep these technicians in the field, because we have some really good technicians, but we're losing them to other avenues because we can't pay them enough, or we're not giving them enough benefits, or just their work environment is not what they want.
Right.
But you bring up a good point about that.
Yeah. And, you know, like they say, like the number one rule of business is it's about people, right? And it's so right. Like, hopefully some of these large corporations that maybe have a little bit more of a business mindset, maybe have an understanding that it is far more expensive to continue to train new employees than it is to actually invest in the employees that you have and continue their training and education and utilization and so on and so forth. And I don't know, maybe that's a pipe dream, maybe that's naive, but at least that's kind of what I hope. And the other point to that, or the other side of that, is, you know, working in academia, working with veterinary students every day, especially in Molly's class, I got to know a lot of the students very well because they were friends of hers. And I ask a number of students every year, like, what their career plans are. And over the last, I think, over 3 years now that I've been there, I have had less than one handful, like maybe two or three students, who have actually said to me their career goal is to own a hospital. Hmm. Nobody, like in my very small subset of veterinary students I've asked, very few of them actually have a career goal of owning their own hospital or buying into a practice. And if that's going to continue to be a trend, then there's going to be more and more of these hospitals available to be bought up by major corporations. And, you know, it's just going to be very interesting to see where those roads kind of cross or come together down the road, because I feel like that is where it's going to have to start. And we'll just have to see.
Well, and Molly would probably be a better, and Robin would probably be a better person to ask about this. But if you think about it, the amount of debt that veterinarians have coming out of vet school, you know, it's astronomical, and they're trying to figure out, how am I going to pay back this debt, instead of saying, okay, how am I going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars into buying a practice where I still have over $100,000 in debt.
Right.
I can't start thinking about that until I start thinking about this.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably a big part of why veterinarians are not interested in buying practices anymore.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they're few and far between now that are privately owned practices. And like I said, just the amount of debt that they have coming out of vet school, that's not even something they can possibly fathom at this point, when they're just coming out of vet school, or as students, and like you were saying.
Right. And, you know, there's not a lot of small business management type classes in vet school, if you will. I mean, I think there is. I think in second year, I think we have maybe like a veterinary economics type course. It's a very short course, but unless they get that kind of stuff in undergrad, they're certainly not learning how to run a veterinary hospital in vet school. And so there's just, I don't know, there's a lot of interesting things there that I think we'll have to figure out. But definitely being in academia the last few years, I think there's a lot of issues that face veterinary medicine that we don't need to get into today that we'll get into throughout this series. But I think a lot of them can all be traced back to academia. And if we can maybe somehow get the AVMA to start looking at that and adjusting some of these things, I think a lot of things can actually be corrected while these future veterinarians are still students. Right. Before they actually become veterinarians. And yeah. And that's one thing I would really like to see happen.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much, Jeff. I really appreciate doing this interview. I feel like I learned a lot from you. I've known you for how long now?
I was just trying to think of this myself.
About 6 years now.
Yeah.
We've known each other about 6 years. And, you know, even now I'm learning stuff about you that I didn't know before. This is really great. I appreciate you coming on to our show and letting me interview you.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't wait to return the favor.
All right, great. Thank you all so much for listening. Remember, we wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for you, our listeners. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Jeff for being a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe. And don't forget to like our page on Facebook. If you want to share our page to all your friends, please do so. The more exposure we get from our listeners, the more our podcast will grow. You can find us at facebook.com/vettechcafe. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at vettechcafe. And our website is vettechcafe.podbean.com. I'm assuming if you're listening to this, you've found us through one of those social media platforms already. Very soon, we hope to be on all the podcast platforms to make our show that much easier to find.